Today on The Grave Talks, Grandma's Haunted House, a conversation with Chris Nielsen. It's that time of night, the time every child knows, bedtime, time of day the lights go out and one is expected to lay down and fall asleep. It's a time of peace, relaxation, until through the corner of the doorway, down a dimly lit hole, one sees a little boy who shouldn't be there, standing, staring at you. You quickly pull the covers over your head, only to peek out and discover that the little boy has not disappeared. He's still there, staring intently. This moment would begin a paranormal journey that would take Chris Nielsen to places he never imagined. This is his story.
Yeah, so the interest in paranormal, honestly, it feels like it almost teeters on stereotype for me. So growing up, my grandparents played a huge part in raising me. And it actually all kind of started at my grandparents' house. So this would be my dad's parents. To this day, and I've been doing like investigating formally for 12, 13 years now. Been Arizona to Pennsylvania. Someday I'll get like that coast to coast because it just sounds better thing going. but to this day, it's one of the most haunted places I've ever been. And I, you know, looking back, I don't know if it's because, you know, we just spent so much time there, or, you know, we were the residents. We had a bit more of an intimate relationship with the spirits. But to this day, just one of the most haunted places I had ever been. It was the parsonage for the church that was next door. It was a funeral home for a while. The basement served as kind of like a temporary morgue because of that. There was local, I don't know if you call it local legend, but we had heard from people who had been in the town for quite a while. There was actually a stopping point on the Underground Railroad. And it was kind of cool looking into that. You know, as an adult, there is actually this kind of concealed room that you can only reach through a trap door that's now sealed off in the living room. So just all sorts of kind of, you know, cool, interesting history to it.
And this is your grandparents' house.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. Continue on.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess it all... And for me, it almost kind of fell back to like a singular event. Like we always knew the house was kind of funky. They had a couple dogs that always kind of avoided like the entrance point to the house. My grandma loved wind chimes, and she would have them kind of up on the like top tier shelves of the cabinet. So the only really time they made a sound was when you open and close those cabinets, just because they're flush against the door. And it would sound like people just kind of walking by, chiming those wind chimes. My grandma has honestly, one of my favorite stories. She had this beautiful, I think it was actually antique, navy blue carpet. And one day she's vacuuming and she turns around, puts a vacuum away, and there's these little dirt footprints like on the carpet. So she turns around, she gets the vacuum back out, she re-vacuums the floor, turns around, puts the vacuum away. Again, there's another set of footprints there. And I just remember her telling me, she was like, you know, I was just like, damn it, quit messing up my carpet. And it just kind of stopped from there. And that's, I kind of think where my idea of like the spirit, like we could actually interact with spirits, where that little seed kind of got planted in. And for me, my first big experience was in that house. And that's what kind of, you know, started this whole process. So my dad worked in law enforcement as I was growing up. He was a corrections officer for Buchanan County in Iowa. So naturally, his hours were kind of all over the place. And there was one weekend we were staying with him, and he got thrown on a super early morning shift. Like, I think 3:30 or 4 in the morning he had to go in. So he, you know, bundles the little 8-year-old Chris up, and we have to go over to grandma and grandpa's so they'll take care of me for the day. And he, you know, gets me in the front door, and he was like, you know what, don't be a little shit, you know, you gotta be quiet so grandma and grandpa don't wake up. So naturally I'm just trying to be as quiet as possible. I'm totally kidding about that. My dad absolutely loved me. never talked poorly to me like that. But you know, I knew I had to be quiet because, you know, grandma and grandpa are sleeping. It's super early in the morning. So to kind of give you an idea of how I saw what I saw when I saw it, you go in the front door of their house and you can either go up the stairs, which kind of run parallel to this entrance hallway, or you can turn right, which is immediately where the living room is, which is where I was. And I'm laying on a day bed that they had in there. And I'm curled up. I've got my pillow. I've got my blanket. And I roll over. And from where I was laying, you could see the stairs. And there's this little boy. And he's just kind of like, he's, you know how like little kids do. They get down on their haunches and he's holding the rungs of the, basically the hold of the banister. And he's just kind of looking at me. And I do like art stuff. So I've actually, you know, I've taken the time to try to remember his face, draw him out. And he was just, like I said, he was staring at me. And, you know, I did the universal 8-year-old self-care technique, which was to, you know, throw the blanket over my head. Because, you know, I was terrified of this kid.
Sure.
And I know, and I've had a lot of my own personal stories like this, and I've heard tons of other people's stories where, you know, when you encounter, you know, especially a solid figure like that, it's very quick, it's very fleeting. You know, you look and 1 second they're gone. So, unfortunately for 8-year-old Chris, that was not the case, because and it was probably only a few minutes, but I felt like I held that blanket over my head what felt like years. And I pull the blanket down and he's still there and just kind of, you know, checking me out. So threw the blanket over my head and I did not move until my grandparents got up, and that was like 6 or 7 in the morning.
Wow. I mean, after you had that experience and you saw this character, this child there, what, you know, what's going through your mind when you do get up in the morning? I mean, how are you processing all of it initially before you even say anything to anyone?
So I think as an 8-year-old kid, like you just have that, you know, oh man, that was scary. And it's, a lot of people talk about fear being a fight or flight response only. You know, you're either going to run away or you're going to start swinging. But I think people seriously underestimate how much of a paralytic the fear can really be too. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I didn't know what to think of it. I knew that, you know, that part of the house was weird for the dogs. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in kind of that environment where it was one of those things. It was just openly talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, these are the ghosts of the house. So I thought I just had kind of one of those like experiences like a dad and Aunt Jackie and grandma and grandpa kind of talked about, but I didn't. It was one of those things. It took me a really long time to actually fully process what my thoughts on it were. And I don't think it really came around till I started doing the actual paranormal research aspect of it. And, you know, looking back, I was a little kid, and that was a little kid. And he was probably just like, oh man, you know, someone to play with. That's so cool. I mean, I wasn't the most gracious at, you know, accepting that. I'm guessing it was some sort of an invitation, or I wasn't the best at being like, heck yeah, little boy, let's play. But, I actually, they held the house and the family for quite a long time. So I did actually get to develop a bit of a relationship with him. Found out through like an EVP session. His name was Greg. And there have been occasions where, you know, Greg has actually come to visit me as an adult at like the places I live.
I want to get to that in a moment. I want to ask a little bit more about when you had this experience, and you said that your family was already, you know, kind of open to it. You as a child said that you, you know, had kind of overheard them discussing these sort of things and their own experiences, you know, in the background. So when you had this experience, did you bring it up to your grandparents or your parents or anything at the time and say, hey, this happened to me last night?
And part of me wishes I had been a little more direct about it. I don't remember having like in-depth conversations, but I just remember asking, like, has anybody ever like seen a little boy here? And nobody had. And I didn't want to, you know, a lot of the stuff they were talking about was a little less, you know, concrete. Mm-hmm. in that it was, you know, the wind chimes and the dogs. And at one point someone had seen, it was like an attachment for the vacuum, like fly across the room, mm-hmm. Which is all, you know, kind of, you know, crazy stuff. But I had the fear of like almost coming across as more crazy. And, you know, having that, I even then had that fear of just having that response of, you know, oh, you were just imagining it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
despite the fact it was, you know, it was kind of openly talked about in the house. That's some next level stuff right there.
Sure. I mean, it's one of those things. It probably makes it though easier, would you say, to kind of digest it though? The fact that your family wasn't poo pooing it and wasn't like, well, it's just in your mind. It was a dream or this or that.
Oh, for sure. Actually, you know, heading down the road in my paranormal, I always want to call it career, but career implies some sort of payment. but it is one of those like kind of all encompassing things sure. in my life now.
Yeah.
And moving forward, I actually co-found my first team back in the day with my dad.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Prior to having that experience, was there anything else? I know you said that was the big one. That was the big experience for you in that house. But prior to that, had you had any run-ins yourself personally, or was it all kind of, you know, family lore and things that people would talk about?
I remember on occasion hearing the wind chimes, and I knew, and it's weird because it was actually that entranceway where I saw him, where the dogs would act weird. So my aunt lived with my grandparents for quite a while when I was younger. And she had two dogs. She had TJ, who was a, you know, big old Rottweiler, and Cammy was a little pit mix. And they were both just the sweetest dogs, mm-hmm. best disposition. But I would remember them, somebody would go out into the kitchen, and they would, as they had to like go through that doorway, kind of slow down. They wouldn't have that full trot. They would kind of like hug the doorway and kind of keep an eye. That area, but nothing quite like that up to that point.
Yeah. So you had this experience, you get a bit older. Tell me about the boy, you know, revisiting you. What do you recall, like the second time he came and made an appearance?
So since then, his appearances have been kind of fleeting. It's almost kind of more when I think about it. I had a good friend of mine who's a, very talented psychic medium. She actually like let me know, like he comes and he visits. And for quite a while, I'm a little bit of a gypsy soul. I actually spent quite a few years of my adult life just traveling full time. I had a camper. I worked campground jobs back and forth. And she's like, he absolutely loves when you ride around the golf cart. And that was actually a big part of my job. I was a manager up at Spook Haven Campground up in McGregor, Iowa. For a few seasons, and that was, you know, part of the job was kind of going around doing, you know, routine, just kind of going through either like dropping off like fire bundles or having to do maintenance stuff. It was one of the things she was like, he really enjoys that. He likes, you know, riding by the waterfall. Mm-hmm. And now it's become one of those situations where I almost kind of get the vibe when he's around. So I have the tendency to, I'm a bit of an empath, and I'm also I'm recently kind of coming out of the closet as a clairvoyant psychic. So I have the tendency to see things, and I know I'm not schizophrenic because I can shut it on and off. Mm-hmm. So there are occasions. I actually, just this last weekend, I was at an event. I was doing a presentation, and I don't remember, I wasn't even specifically speaking about Greg, but I was, you know, talking about how everybody seems to be afraid of things these days. And it's not say not that you're, you know, hearing, you know, tap on the windows at night. It's probably just Greg. And I just like, I pulled that name completely out of left field. And I saw his little head poke in, and he's like, what's up? And it was just such a cool experience for me, because he's just been on occasion my buddy who will visit. We have interactions on investigations where he'll actually like, I've come to recognize his voice in the form of EVP, mm-hmm. and he will, you know, on occasion chime in throughout the years, just kind of like, hey, or I remember one point I was doing an investigation at Edinburgh Manor, which is a very, very near and dear location to my heart. There's the little girl on the ground floor that everybody calls Susie. I was like, and if there's, you know, any kids here who, you know, want to play with this ball here, go ahead and play with it and let me know, you know, talk to my recorder and tell me that you're going to play with it. And I heard his voice come through, and it was just this very excited me. Like, it, I want to play with the ball.
Mm-hmm. What an interesting concept. And we'll talk more about the idea of bringing your own ghost to an investigation in just a moment. But yeah. I mean, tell me about, you know, obviously you've had many a years here now. You got to wonder, who is Greg? We know, where did he come from? Where was he? Why does he start tagging along with you at a certain point? Have you ever dug into the history or try to identify who this boy might have been?
I've done my best. I haven't come up with anything concrete by any, you know, use of the word. Mm-hmm. So with the house being, you know, funeral home, it was one of those situations where I would go like try to look through like death records, but it wasn't like a formal funeral home. It was like a kind of a proxy funeral home for the church. Mm-hmm. And I haven't, you know, I couldn't find anything that seemed to match his description. Judging by like how he was dressed when I first saw him and how I've seen him like the few times that I have since then, I would guess him to be probably later 1800s, maybe early 1900s, but that's really the best I got with that.
Yeah. Do you ever, I mean, then the way you got the name Greg, that just, you said it just kind of came to you, is that accurate? Or did he ever identify himself flat out through an EVP or something with a name?
Yeah, it was through EVP. Okay. So back when we first started our whole trying to set up a team, me and my dad back in the day, we, my grandparents' house was like just kind of that instinctual like go-to place,
yeah,
to do investigations aside from like, you know, the occasional cemetery and stuff. And I make sure it's like one of the first audio files to get transferred when I get a new computer. Mm-hmm. It was just the question, like, I saw a little boy on the stairs back when I was really young. Can you give me your name? And it was just Greg. It just very crisp. It was clear.
Yeah. So when you started doing investigations kind of at a beginning stage, and you and your dad, and you're at your grandparents' house, obviously we've established your parents believe in this stuff and have had experiences. What sort of stories did your dad have about, I'm assuming, was this a house he grew up in, or was this a house that they got later?
So this was actually a house they ended up getting a little bit later on. He had his own kind of interactions with things at a, actually, weirdly enough, a different house.
Oh.
Apparently, my grandparents have a thing for buying haunted houses.
Yeah. or your grandparents have a thing for being haunted. That could be,
or
too.
Or that, too, yeah.
But so tell me, like, what were some of his experiences going into this that really just kind of made this a good team to be jumping into this together, other than being father-son?
So he is one of those things, and it was kind of with me too, where it was just kind of a lifelong fascination of his. He had seen a few things as a child. I remember him telling me about there were these things in his room that would, you know, like throw his Hot Wheels and kind of say bad things to him. And he would have these too. And he says he remembers them as more silhouettes, but wearing kind of closer to like Victorian era clothing, and basically protecting him from these things. So that's kind of one of those childhood experiences, mm-hmm. which, you know, turns out is relatable, that you just kind of carry with you, and it spikes that kind of lifelong obsession. So I remember there being, you know, books in the house growing up of like I can't for life me remember what the collection is, but it's like a thinner book and black hardcover. It covers topics like ESP and like time travel and UFOs. And for some reason, those are a particular childhood memory, that book set, about all sorts of, you know, mm-hmm. weird stuff.
So he said that he believed that some of these things were kind of protecting him. Protecting yeah. him from what?
Whatever these things were that were in his room, when he said he was about 4 years old when it started happening, where they would, you know, throw his Hot Wheels, and he remembers there being like his closet had stairs that led to nowhere, and he always thought they kind of came from there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just kind of these like negative things that were in the room.
Did you ever feel that? And obviously, this was his house and one that was previous to you. But when you were at your grandparents' house at the newer haunted house, if you will, the more current haunted house, did you ever feel anything negative, or did you ever feel like, you know, Greg was there to protect you from anything?
I never really felt anything negative there. So it was always very, it was, so on a paranormal investigation, you get situations where there's like a higher energy and it just generally feels uncomfortable. And on occasion there would be that where it just felt like there is a lot of them around.
Mm-hmm.
Is how I've come to identify that feeling anyways, but never anything bad. So over the course of our, you know, years investigating there, we've narrowed it down to about 13 individual spirits actually kind of running around there that we were able to isolate specifically. And all of them are, you know, genuinely good. There's, you know, this beautiful lady, and we're not sure why, but she was mourning someone or something in the upstairs bathroom. And, you know, there was Greg, and there's this stricter old lady who used to be in my grandpa's office. She was in there, but never anything inherently negative. The only time that, you know, something would happen that a person might register as negative was, I'm going to be completely honest, it was well-deserved, which I would, you know, be happy to kind of go into that story. So when we first started doing this, the paranormal investigation started kind of prior to the paranormal investigation team. My library was doing like a closeout thing, and I actually got a hold of a bunch of old Hans Holzer books.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading through those, and I was a big fan of Ghost Hunters when it first came on. And some of those like later shows. And I remember we had like just started doing this. This is maybe our second or third investigation. And I'm upstairs in kind of a spare bedroom. And we were doing an EVP session. And I had asked the question, like, hey, who do you like better, more, me or the big bald guy over there? His name's Rex, which is my dad's name. And the EVP we got back was a pretty concise Rex. And for some reason, I took it personally. And I went upstairs and I decided to, you know, confront this person. And I try not to to shit talk too much, but I wanted to go up there and be like a particular guy with spiky hair and really just kind of challenge this thing to a fight. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ranting and raving upstairs and, you know, trying to elicit a response that way. And as I'm walking out of the room, I actually had two hands, as I like crossed the threshold of the door, two hands basically pushed me out. And it was enough to like, I lost my balance. I fell over and I turned just as that door was kind of slowly shutting behind me. And that's when I had a moment that really kind of clicked, that I was like, oh my gosh, I just went up there and I was, you know, and I was insulting people. They weren't, mm-hmm. They're not ghosts. They're not a thing. They're a what? They're not a what? They're like, that's a who. And I was going upstairs just being, you know, blatantly disrespectful for the sake of, you know, a response.
And I asked,
that was a,
yeah, my yeah, question was going to be why such a aggressive response to the spirit telling you it liked the other person better? Was it all, I mean, was it an act essentially? Were you truly that upset, or were you were just trying to put on an act essentially to elicit a response? If it, like, you know, it's like yelling at a dog or something. It's like,
yeah. No, so I was big into a particular TV show where like that was the method.
Yeah,
you go in and like that's, but it was one of those situations where at first I wasn't that butthurt about the situation.
Sure.
But you know, you get up there and you start kind of getting in that mode, and I almost kind of like whipped myself up into this weird 100% unnecessary frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's kind of one of those situations where at the end of the day, I don't think I would have changed anything, because that was a huge learning experience for me.
Sure. After you had that experience, and you know, you're yelling at the ghosts and calling them out and things like that. I mean, how did you reflect upon that? You know, I know you said you kind of had that realization of, wait, these are people. This is what kind of made you go, you know, I've seen this on TV, but this is probably not, you know, the best of tactics, if you will.
Yeah, it was a thing where I had seen the little boy when I was younger, but I didn't really have anything super concrete up to that point. Like, you know, I had found, you know, a few EVPs here and there, and I had, you know, read things in theory, and I'd gone out to cemeteries and kind of heard some weird stuff in the middle of the night. But there's a certain amount of gravity that gets added when it's a real in-time interaction on the plane that we perceive.
Sure.
It was a, like, they were upset enough at me to have a physical response.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think they're able to kind of read that this is you just kind of acting out, and they're kind of like putting you in line, like, shut up, like, whatever, like, there's no, I mean, because if you were just observing this, you'd be like, why is this person doing this? Or were they feeling like, wow, he's like kind of threatening us, and they were pushing back in that way? I mean, what sort of feeling did you get out of that energy at that moment?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think it was, this is poor behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we're going to deal with this poor behavior, because I feel like, you know, watching, you know, people act like that, they don't get the gravity of what it is they're
sure
doing and what I was doing in that moment. So I think it was a combination of an actual retaliation to poor behavior and let's teach this guy something. Because mm-hmm. I'm very prone to having to learn things the hard way.
Sure. How interesting. I mean, so you had that experience that was fairly early on, you said, in investigating?
Yeah. Within my first probably 3 months or so. Yeah.
So you get that pushed feeling. Continue on. Like, how did things continue to evolve for you after having that experience, after feeling pushed, you know, almost, you know, you were doing some aggressive things, but, you know, they also kind of pushed back literally. And so do you we can do some things back that you may not like either. How did that, you know, did that encourage your curiosity into this? Did it make you pause for a moment? What were you thinking?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it just, I tell everybody this is one of those situations, like, it was a weird, like, 2 a.m. decision to even, like, you know, form my first team. And I started looking up on this as kind of like a whim. And it's been this weird little snowball thing that just kind of keeps accumulating and has no real sign of stopping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that push was kind of one of those situations where I got an answer, like, holy crap. Yes. Like, you hear people talk about, like, oh, I was touched. But it actually happened. And I was like, oh my gosh, they touched. Like, where does this end?
Yeah.
You know, how, what happens from here? And it added a lot of validity for me in my mind. And I think that happens when you get something that physical. So I had a little bit more validation, which made me just a little bit more curious. And going forward, I knew a better way to conduct myself doing this. It was absolutely a learning experience. I've been significantly more polite in all of my investigations since.
So tell me about some of the follow-up investigations. Obviously, you had this location that was already someplace you had access to through family. How did it continue to branch out where you were going to other locations that, you know, you didn't have a whole lot of experience with?
Oh my gosh, it's been just an absolute trip. So and it hasn't been just like a, it's been a physical trip too, but, even for me, you know, spiritually, I mentioned, I've kind of come into my way as being a bit of a, and I hate the labels, but like a clairvoyant. My beautiful girlfriend, Kelly, who's actually my current partner. We do a lot of stuff at Traveler's Moon, and she's been a gifted psychic medium ever since she was a little kid. And she's kind of brought me into this. A good friend of mine, Coyote Chris Sutton, got me into shamanism mm-hmm. in the last few years before his passing.
Sure.
But I mean, early on, I was I was young enough, or I had just enough young and dumb in me.
Sure.
I always go to my example of Edinburgh Manor. I mentioned it was like a very special location to me. So in 2013, I had gotten accepted to film school, and for financial reasons, it wasn't going to work out. But I knew I wanted to make a movie, and I actually got this idea to do a documentary on a haunted location. But I wanted it to be a paranormal investigation, and instead of doing, you know, one night, I wanted to up the stakes somehow. Like I said, young and dumb. I actually ended up closing myself to Edinburgh Manor for 5 days completely alone, which is a, you know, extremely haunted location. And, you know, I had mentioned the whole young and dumb thing, I think, was a huge driving force in that. But I think that was another one of those huge kind of milestones for me. And I'm not even sure how specifically. If that makes sense, that it was such a huge part, but it was just a life-changing experience for me.
I want to hear about it. Before we jump into what happened to you, give me, you know, I don't usually say this, but give me the shorter nutshell version, because otherwise it could be quite a long story of Edinburgh Manor, just so the audience has some idea of what it is. If you were to describe it in, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, how would you do it?
Yeah, so the Edinburgh Manor is just enormous brick structure in the middle of absolute nowhere, Jones County, Iowa. So this property itself was opened in 1856 when the poor farm systems were in place, mm-hmm. and it was the Jones County Poor Farm. In 1911, the brick building that we now know and love today, the Edinburgh Manor, was erected, but it was opened as the Jones County Home for the Incurably Insane. Naturally developed a bit more of a PC title over the years, eventually becoming Edinburgh Manor.
There's so much hope in that title. It's like, oh, there's a lot of chances here, promises or something. Like, you right. go there, it's like, you're screwed, you're done.
Oh, yeah, there's like this zero opportunity for good things to happen. Yeah. And had I heard that was like its original title, I might have been a little less lenient to like basically lock myself in for 5 days by myself.
But, maybe we need a little more of those type of places where they're just so blunt. And then there's like no chance. Somebody's going to like, I really think I'm no, you're not. It's just not going to work out. I'm sorry.
Right. Definitely.
Have you seen the name of the place? No, I'm sorry. You're just not. It's horrible, but anyhow.
Oh, yeah. Where was I? So, yeah, over the course of all of those years between the poor farm and the Edinburgh Manor, the more optimistic title to the building, over 150 people actually died within its walls, whether it be from natural causes, there were suicides by arsenic, people jumping off of out the windows. Just a very... very funky place, a lot of strange energy to it. You know, tons of local spirits. You have all sorts of personalities in there. You have just kind of some of the residents who are minding their own business. I had mentioned a little bit earlier, a Susie who lives on the ground floor. She is the sweetest little girl. She has interacted with me literally every time I've been by. And I actually went through a weird phase afterwards where I would go back to visit just in the middle of the night. Like, I'd make sure there was no investigators there, and I just kind of look in the windows. I think I developed some sort of personality disorder from the experience. But even like little interaction, like little visits like that, I would get something out of her. You have, you know, the basement where the thing they call the Joker is said to reside, where if you're looking for your dark and nasty, you're going to find it in that basement. And this is all information that I didn't have before, you know, going ahead and, you know, shutting myself in there for 5 days alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was intense in the most, pretty much every facet of that word, because it was intensely, you know, frightening. I had I went through like 3 packs of cigarettes, probably a pound of coffee. I wasn't sleeping. I was a physical and mental wreck. The first night I stayed there, I wanted to say I stayed in the manor literally the whole time, the full 110 hours. And after the first night, I slept maybe a half hour because it wasn't physically possible. I had there's a little sunroom when you go in, and I thought, this is my spot. I set a little pop-up tent in the sunroom because I thought, this will be my safe space. If I can't see them, they can't see me, kind of thing. And my brain didn't take into consideration that sound passes through nylon pretty easily. So I was hearing conversations down the hall. And when that died off, I would hear footsteps above me. And when that wasn't happening, it sounded like somebody like smacked a rock or something against the floor. Just random stuff like that all night. And then around 5:30 in the morning that first night, I fell asleep. At 6 a.m., I was woken by the sound of just a heavy steel door slamming maybe 10 feet from my head. And I realized that actually sleeping in this place is probably not the most advantageous of thing. So I ended up crashing in the, they have these little houses out back where investigators were kind of able to go. And it's mostly for the bathroom because there's no running water in the manor. But I remember back when I first went, they weren't even like finished. Like it was that weird sub foam that you get to carpets. Mm-hmm. That's what was all over the floor. So I just ended up like crashing in a little nest of blankets. The whole experience, I actually, I'm in the process of working on a book on, just because there was so much, and the documentary, fell through for very, very unfortunate reasons.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Chris Nielsen. In part two, does Chris believe he's been bringing a ghost boy with him on every investigation? What happened at the Edinburgh Manor that made it so haunted? What happened to Chris when he locked himself in the Edinburgh Manor for 7 days? And what do the spirits of the Edinburgh Manor want with those who pass through its halls? All of that and more in part two of our conversation with Chris. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.